This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
Football season is back, and so is another edition of the Dustin McComas Show on theyak.com. This is episode 25, and I am, of course, Dustin McComas of orangebloods.com. And I am joined today by Aaron Dickens of our colleagues at the Texas Tech Rivals website, redraidersports.com. You can hear him all the time on Tech Talk 97.3 at Double T 97.3. Aaron, I know for sure you have one listener down here. My wife's cousin, Travis, Texas Tech grad, always tunes in. He was fired up to learn that you guys were having me on as an occasional guest. So,
oh, that's awesome.
You are reaching the Austin audience down here, and he really enjoys you guys. And I said, oh, I didn't know you were, you know, still listening, even though you moved back. But you guys do a great job up there, and thanks for having me on yesterday. And you guys brought up something that I had been thinking about since Monday, just because it was kind of a weird Tom Herman press conference. It kind of felt in some ways like a Mac Brown era type press conference, where there are a lot of questions about things other than football and other than the upcoming game. And then it dawned on me when you guys mentioned it, we're so used to this matchup being later in the calendar, you know, or around Halloween, and in November or something like that. It's just kind of, this game is usually played when, you know, there's a lot of anticipation building, and we kind of have a really good feel for what these two teams are. So what's kind of the buzz, I guess, in Lubbock around this game? Obviously, I think they're going to have some fans there, as Texas did. For their home opener. What's kind of have you guys noticed that too, that there's not really as much buzz, or is it different up there?
It's a great point. Cause I mean, I think if you think about it, I believe the only other time in relative recent memory that these two teams have played this early was, I think, 2010. Texas was coming off of its appearance in the title game. Tech was in its first year under Tommy Tuberville. Texas was ranked, I think, top five at the time. It was pretty early, and so it was a tight game. Texas won, of course, but I think Tech fans left that game thinking, okay, well, listen, Red Raiders hung with this top five team. The defense looked really, really good. If you play like this the rest of the way out, then you'll be in great shape. And then, as we all know, you know, Texas was not a top five team in 2010. Texas Tech was not a very good team in 2010. So I think your point about not knowing what these two teams are right now is a good one. You know, certainly if we're going off of the opener, Texas Tech is not a very good team, especially on defense. Texas did what it was supposed to do against UTEP, and we'll see what happens on Saturday. Obviously, our friends in the desert think that this will be a fairly easy affair for Texas. And if Texas, you know, defensive backfield plays like it did against Houston Baptist, then it certainly will be.
Yeah, speaking of our friends in the desert, I can't recall the last time I've seen a line like that for this matchup. And I think that actually works both ways. I mean, I think when Tech has come to Austin in recent years, I don't remember it looking like that. And certainly when Texas plays on the road up there. Speaking of that opener, because you know, I was talking to you before we hopped on here. I think a lot of people started really closely following that score as it was happening, but I'm not sure how many people actually watched it. So I guess generally just describe, you know, how that game played out against HBU. Texas Tech ended up winning 35-33. I think a lot of focus is on that secondary. But I think the linebackers kind of have a reputation as being a strong unit. I think they played well, but was it as simple as the secondary just – did they not have bodies? Did they just – confusion, breakdown? How do you describe, you know, the struggles that they had defensively?
So we'll start with this. There were some players missing either due to, you know, just normal football injuries or like COVID or COVID-related issues. So their presence would have helped. But certainly when you're talking about a Big 12 team – and a lower level FCS team, that shouldn't matter, right? That shouldn't be the difference between a respectable defensive showing and giving up a 570-yard passer. So yeah, it just it didn't look good. I mean, Bailey Zappe, the quarterback for HBU, started like 37 games. He's a pretty good quarterback. I think you'll see him maybe as an undrafted free agent type or a later round pick.
And I agree, which is really rare for that type of program. I mean, that's a legitimately good quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is probably better as a quarterback than you would see at a lot of Group of Five programs around the region. They've got the Stern brothers. I'm sure that the Texas fans are familiar with them. They're very good. They could play, in the Big 12 probably. But, yeah, they just couldn't stop them. I mean, there were holes all over the place. Zach Kittley, who's the OC at HBU, is the son of Tech track and field coach Wes Kittley. Zach Kittley learned under Cliff Kingsbury. He was on that staff for years. He was essentially Cliff's kind of right-hand man on the field. And so you've got a lot of Tech connections in that staff. The son of the university president is an assistant coach on that staff. You've got a former Tech offensive lineman coaching the O-line there. So a lot of air raid principles, a lot of Cliff Kingsbury-inspired offense. And, you know, the funny thing is that these two teams obviously weren't supposed to play this year, right? This was kind of one of those hastily scheduled non-conference games after all the schedules went to hell. And so since these teams weren't scheduled to really ever play, and because of all the Tech connections, HBU's been up in Lubbock. Like these two staffs have you know, collaborated and, hey, come on up. Let's talk about what we're doing. We'll show you what we're doing, open book, et cetera. And so, you know, lo and behold, in August, they end up scheduling this game. You couldn't. Bailey Zappe was very good about getting the ball out of his hands quickly and also moving around in the pocket to buy himself just enough time and getting decent throwing angles to find open receivers. And unfortunately for the Red Raiders, and I think if you're Texas Tech, hopefully not a sign of things to come, they were open receivers all over the place, especially Josh and Jarrett Stearns. I mean, those guys, 330 yards between them receiving.
Yeah, they had some huge games, and I think a couple of Texas fans were looking at that box score saying, wait a minute, should we have recruited these guys? Like, I gather from what you're saying here that Texas Tech is not going to be scheduling Houston Baptist again in the future. Like, that level of familiarity obviously can present some problems, especially on short notice.
Yeah, the thing that I'm most intrigued by with Houston Baptist is Bailey Zappe. Because if this year is kind of a freebie for everybody, do we see him at a Power Five program next year? Like, if you're a Big 12 team and you need a quarterback, you could do a lot worse than a grad transfer Bailey Zappe.
Absolutely, yeah. And he probably helped put himself on the map with that performance against Texas Tech. Alan Bowman, a guy that has put up some monstrous numbers in the past. I was kind of looking back and thinking back to some games I've seen him play. And, you know, obviously that game against Houston in 2018 comes to mind where he just went nuts. I forget what it was. He was there 605 or 650 yards passing. Obviously that was under a different head coach, Cliff Kingsbury, who is put up a lot of points and yards in the NFL right now with Kyler Murray and the Arizona Cardinals. But is he 100% healthy? I would assume he's got to be close to it since he was out there playing in the opener. And, you know, how does he look? And can we expect, you know, the types of numbers that he put up in that opener against Houston Baptist pretty consistently in this Texas Tech offense this year?
You know, it's so Bowman, he attempted 52 passes in that opener. He missed on 14 incompletions. There were actually a couple of drops. There were two bad overthrows that if you connect on those, you know, maybe this game does not look nearly as, you know, embarrassing, ugly, terrible, whatever word you want to use, as it ended up being. And yet, for a lot of programs, that would be banner afternoon, banner evening. And yet Tech, you know, Tech fans, pretty spoiled, and they have a right to be in terms of quarterback play. And he's been a bit of a lightning rod. It's interesting. He is kind of viewed as this known quantity, even though due to the injuries that you kind of referenced, the collapsed lungs, the broken collarbone last year, we haven't really seen him on the field a whole lot. I think he started and finished, I think maybe 9 games, maybe 10 now. And so while he's been around for 3 years, I mean, his first appearance was in that 2018 opener against Ole Miss. You know, he just hasn't played a whole lot. And so I think you're still kind of working through just some of the natural, you know, learning curve when it comes to a starting quarterback. And you throw in the new system. He only had 3 games in that system last year before the collarbone shut him down. And so, yeah, it's going to be – I'm very curious to kind of follow his progression this year because I still don't know if we have, you know, kind of an average – Big 12 starting quarterback or someone that can be better than that. You know, he played fine against Houston Baptist, had a couple of bad overthrows, had a interception that, you know, clearly he'd like to have back. But I still don't know that we know a whole lot. From a number standpoint, if you kind of compare his numbers as a starter to Jet Duffy and what he did as a starter. And the knock on Duffy was doesn't know the offense, careless with the football, you know, electric playmaker, can do some really good things, but also can do some things that can really hurt you. Their numbers are pretty similar. And Duffy, all of his starts were against Big 12 teams, whereas Bowman's been able to play Houston Baptist and the non-conference opponents last year. So, yeah, I think Bowman – could end up being pretty good, and he could end up being kind of average. Nothing would really surprise me. I mean, he could start for you next year and the year after, or you could see Maverick McIver or Henry Columbia, the Utah State transfer, or Baron Morton, the true freshman out of Eastland. So, yeah, I think Bowman is one of the maybe bigger wild cards in the Big 12 this year in terms of quarterbacks.
Yeah, you bring up a great point about just the – he's been around so long, and I think, you know, observers outside of Lubbock kind of, oh, okay, he's been at Tech a few years. Oh, yeah, he's got these performances. Surely he's got to be good, you know. He's going to put up some big numbers. But, yeah, he's kind of like a little bit of an inexperienced quarterback despite being that program for as long as he has. You mentioned, you know, the broken collarbone and only getting 3 games in that new system. How is that system – different than what was going on under Cliff? I think people look at Texas Tech and, you know, they expect yards and points, and, you know, I think that's going to happen. But, you know, I'm sure there's some differences in the way things were going under Kingsbury compared to this new coaching staff.
So just in general, I think the biggest probably different, and if you're just like a kind of an average football fan, you turn on the TV, or in this case ESPN3 last week, and you watch that game and then one of Tech's games against UTEP or whatever when Cliff was here, not going to see a whole lot. I mean, they're still in shotgun all the time. They're still going to throw it a lot. Biggest difference is that Cliff, I think it was more of kind of a game plan offense. I mean, you saw kind of a lot of new elements week to week within the framework of the offense. Two, this staff is fanatically committed to running 11 personnel pretty much all the time. And so obviously if you follow Texas Tech outside of the, you know, year and a half where Jason Morrow was a freak and one of the best players in the Big 12, haven't really seen a lot of tight ends featured in this Tech offense. I mean, you have to go back to 2004 and Bristow Olamua, you know, before Jason Morrow in terms of tight ends that have really had success. And so you didn't really have anybody on the roster that fit that bill. And so they spun up Dante Thompson out of Ennis, senior, and not really looked the part of a tight end, kind of a bigger receiver, for being honest, but he played probably more snaps last year than almost any other player on offense. I mean, he was on the field all the time, and you didn't really just blow up in the box score. I think he was maybe their 4th or 5th leading receiver, but he was on the field all the time. And, you know, so far, just going off of one game, they're sticking with it. You know, it's Travis Kuntz this year, JUCO transfer, played some last year. He's your starting tight end, was on the field a lot. And so that's probably one of the biggest cosmetic differences, just that, hey, they're going to have a running back and a tight end on the field at all times. Cliff would do two tight or two running backs. He'd go five wide. With this, in terms of personnel groupings, it's pretty much always the same. Now, once they kind of get the roster to where they want it to be and you have some decent options at tight end, maybe they run 12 personnel more. But right now, you're going to see tight ends in the field pretty much all the time for the Red Raiders. And then I think they run the ball a bit more as well. And it helps if you have a kid like Sroder Thompson, who I think is one of the better running backs in the Big 12. But yeah, so run the ball more, tight end, and a little bit less of kind of a week-to-week game plan offense.
You know, 2020 is weird when we're talking about, you know, Texas Tech using 11 personnel in the tight end. And I think Texas is going to roll into Lubbock and use a lot of 12 personnel with two tight ends. And some of that's because of, you know, Jake Smith being out again for this game this weekend. But it's something they did a lot in preseason camp. And it's kind of like Texas fans have been scratching their head a little bit. 2020 just continues to throw us some curveballs. You mentioned Thompson. From what I've read, you know, he's all good for this weekend. How many people have already made street racing jokes about how fast he is? And I think that, you know, that position group, I think could, you know, I think people fixate on the receivers a lot and the quarterback, obviously, but that position group could be a real strength, I think, the running backs.
Oh, no, I think the racing jokes with Thompson, that's totally fair game. I made one on the show.
I was going to say, we got to capitalize on those while we can.
Yeah, no, races through the whole thing. I think if we're talking just – and again, we kind of fall in this trap of overreacting to, you know, what we have seen. And all we have seen so far is one game, and especially this year more than most because there's no real spring practice to kind of lean on in terms of either what you were able to see at practices that you, you know, could attend or what you, you know, heard from coaches and players. But I thought the running backs were probably the best group on offense against Houston Baptist. I mean, Sroder Thompson looked just as good as he did last year. His numbers were very good. And then Taj Brooks, true freshman, he came in and their backup was out, I think, because of COVID-related issues, either close contact or a diagnosis. So Taj Brooks, number two running back, he looked very good for a true freshman. And then Shedarius Townsend, who's an Alabama transfer, came in, kind of a change of pace guy, one of the fastest guys on your team, and he looked good. And you look at receiver, there's just not a lot there in terms of proven guys or guys that you feel good about. I mean, Eric Uzukama was your leading receiver last year for the Red Raiders as a true freshman, really came on strong in the second half of the year. TJ Vasher is one of those guys that's been around a long time. And if you're a sports fan, we kind of have this tendency to just expect, okay, well, he's been there for X number of years, so he should be pretty good. Vasher flashes. I mean, it wouldn't be a shock if he makes a highlight play on Saturday. But his problem is, and I'm sure he's a nice guy, but in terms of just on-field stuff, his problem is he disappears too much, right? He'll make a great play. I mean, he's made some nice plays against Texas in his career, as a matter of fact. And then he'll just disappear for a quarter or two. And he'll have a nice game, and then that'll be it. Former four-star receiver out of Wichita Falls. And he just hasn't been able to really clean up the consistency. And so if he's on, yeah, he's good for you. But the problem is too often he's not. Keyshawn Carter, I thought, had a good game against Houston Baptist. I thought he graded out well. I think it's maybe a bit too early to expect that kind of week in, week out from him. But, yeah, I mean, they've got some guys. But it's kind of like Bowman. We just don't know what they are yet.
Yeah, Vasher. I feel like he's kind of on the Perry Ellis, like, Big 12 plan. It seems like he's been there for like 15 years. I was like, oh yeah, there he is again. You know, he's got stats from 2016 all the way up to 2020. You mentioned
COVID. I will say this about Vasher, though. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
As critical as I have been of him, because he's a senior. Again, he's got some bona fides in terms of you know, what he was ranked as a prospect coming out of high school, the amount of playing time that he's gotten over the years. He's been around a long time, like you said, Perry Ellis. And he just hasn't put it together consistency-wise. But that all being said, third and four, late in the game, you're trying to just finish this game against HBU and get out of there with a win, escape with a win. You need to convert this first down in order to kind of ice it. They go to him on a slant. He snags it, converts the first down, essentially ends the game. So in clutch situations, at least so far this year, he's been good for you if you're the Red Raiders. But again, I need to see more of that from him.
Yeah, he's certainly one of those guys that, you know, the flashes, but the consistency has kind of been up and down. But he'll give you a couple sometimes. It's like, okay, just got to show that on a more consistent basis. You mentioned COVID. It sounds like, you know, that's been something that Texas Tech's had to deal with more than certainly, you know, fortunately for the Longhorns down here, it really hasn't been much of an issue, knock on wood. But how much has that impacted what they were able to do in the preseason? You know, as we both know, like, covering that from our perspective is tough because nobody's, you know, say, oh yeah, this guy's positive, or, you know, nobody's like releasing that information on purpose or leaking it or anything like that. You just kind of, oh wait, there, that guy's not dressed out, or that guy's not playing, or, you know, is this COVID related? What's going on? But how much of an issue has that been for Texas Tech? Because if I'm recalling correctly, I think they did have, you know, pretty significant positive tests at some point.
Yeah. So at this point, they have had, and let me pull up the email so I give you precise numbers. So their latest update was on Monday. And to Tech's credit, and not every program around the country can say this, and not everyone in the Big 12 can say this, that they have been pretty consistent with keeping everyone updated on their numbers, even when the numbers have been, like you said, not good. And you could have hid behind, well, it's a competitive disadvantage, like, you know, that school in Oklahoma, or just hide behind, well, we're a private school and we don't, you know, like Baylor and TCU. They've been pretty transparent. So I continue to offer them kudos whenever we discuss this this topic. So yeah, they've had 75 players within the football program contract COVID-19. All of them, at least based on the email from Monday, have recovered. So as of Monday, they had no active cases within the football program, either players or staff. They've had 5 staff cases of COVID-19. And yeah, no, it has to have affected them. I think that you look at the 75 number and it really stands out. 20 of those, give or take, came in positive, right? When they welcomed all the athletes back on campus in mid-June or whenever that was, that first update was, hey, 24, I think it was, positive cases. But what really gets you is the close contact, right? And it's unlike when you're injured, like you've got an ankle injury or, you know, whatever. You can still be out of practice. You can still go to film sessions. You can still be around the guys. But when you're dealing with this stuff, you're out. Like, you're out. And, you know, when you're dealing with a limited off season and just kind of a wonky situation all around, that has to hurt. Now, I don't know that's why you gave up 600 yards to Houston Baptist. You know, I don't know that anybody is going to want to listen to that as an excuse. But absolutely, it has to have affected them. And I think beyond that, beyond just the matter of missing players, either due to a diagnosis or being determined to be a close contact, you're trying to mitigate all of this, right, as a coach. So you're cross-training everybody. I need to have 5 guys that can snap the ball and play center if needed. I need to have you know, six guys to play middle linebacker or whatever. You get what I'm saying? And so not only are you dealing with maybe fewer players in practice at any given time, you're also in some ways gimping the number of reps at each position because you're trying to cross-train everybody so that if you do have a significant outbreak, you can still kind of make it through a game. And so it's kind of, you're kind of being attacked at both ends to some degree.
Yeah, no, it's just such a weird year. And I don't think people like realize it's not just, like you said, it's not just the games where this can be impacted. It's practice. And oh, by the way, you know, if you, you know, contract this and, you know, even if everything's fine and you're not showing symptoms, or maybe it's just a little cold or whatever it is, that's 14 days of no weight training, no conditioning. You're kind of fall out of game shape to an extent. It's just, yeah, it can have a huge impact. And that's 75. Wow. That's a lot of the roster, but fortunately for all those recoveries, you got to hope that, you know, that's, they've kind of gotten through the worst of it and that's not going to really be much of an issue moving forward.
Yeah, that's the silver lining, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's hopefully down the road you're not dealing with this again.
Much better to, I mean, obviously ideal, no one gets it at all.
Right.
And you're just hunky-dory for 10 games. But probably much better to get it and get most of it behind you, you know, by mid-September than to have something kind of pop up in October or November.
Matt Wells, you know, what's – again, it's such a weird year. I almost feel like it's not a complete mulligan for everybody, because there are going to be games played and hopefully we get through the full slate of games and people are going to be judged on it as they should. But it's still with the COVID and everything else, it's hard to really evaluate these programs, especially from a game-to-game basis, just because there could be huge personnel issues. But what's kind of been the fan base's reaction to him so far? You know, I imagine that wasn't an ideal situation to follow Kingsbury, especially now that he's having success in the NFL. I'm sure Texas Tech fans kind of look at that and say, man, I wish we had him back, or maybe we took something for granted a little bit. But what's kind of been the reaction to Wells thus far? Obviously didn't have the initial season that he wanted to, but you know, they had some issues with the quarterback injuries and things like that. Are people kind of chomping at the bit, and, you know, or is it just kind of like, hey, we just got to have some patience with this?
You know, the Kingsbury stuff is interesting because, you know, you can look at Tommy Tuberville and, you know, it was always going to be difficult to follow up Mike Leach, right? Winningest coach in program history. When he was fired, he was not that far removed from, you know, taking Texas Tech to the heights of college football, you know, a number two ranking and almost making it to a national championship game. And so it was always going to be difficult for Tuberville. And when it didn't look like people expected, and then, of course, when you went 5-7 in 2011 for the first losing season in like 15 plus years, people turned on him and never really came back. With Cliff and Wells, like, Cliff was a Tech guy, right? He was a beloved Red Raider figure. I would say, you know, legendary in many ways as a player, being Mike Leach's first quarterback. But the results were bad. Like, the results were worse than Tommy Tuberville. You look at, you know, 82-27 to TCU in 2014. Three straight losing seasons, which hadn't been done since the early 1980s. Outside of being a Tech guy and putting together some really impressive offenses, if you're looking at just from a purely result standpoint, you would think, or you would assume, or normally you would expect to not have any kind of like wishful thinking about the guy that you just fired. And while I don't think that really many Tech fans go, you know, that maybe you should have just given him one more year, The fact that folks have been so quick, and not everybody, but a number of folks have been so quick to jump on and just conclude definitively, okay, well, Matt Wells is not the answer. He's terrible. And, you know, the sooner that Tech moves on, the better. I find that to be very odd. You know, Cliff is having success in the NFL. I think that his skill set and his personality probably makes him a better fit for the NFL. There is no recruiting, which he did not enjoy. And you could see that in the results in recruiting. But a brilliant offensive mind. I think that his players love him. I think he's got a great relationship with his players. I think his mindset as a coach, his how even keeled he is, how consistent he is in terms of how he interacts with people, is a gigantic asset in the NFL. He's an all around great guy. Like, just from a purely human being standpoint, I know that he has this kind of coach bro persona, or that's how folks view him, but he's just like a legitimately A-plus human being. It didn't work out at Texas Tech. The results were bad. But I think clearly we've seen so far he's a much better fit for the NFL. It's just really – it's funny to see – and funny is probably the wrong word. It is, I think, probably somewhat bittersweet for Tech fans to see guys like Kingsbury and Patrick Mahomes succeed the way that they are succeeding in the NFL, and certainly Pat way more than Cliff to this point. When both of those guys were together at Texas Tech, the results, at least in terms of wins and losses, were mediocre at best. I mean, Pat Mahomes has a losing record as a Tech quarterback. And if we're talking about, like, because Tech just – and I'm going on a gigantic tangent, so I apologize.
No, it's great. Tech, you're taking it where I want it to go.
Tech announced last Thursday that Michael Crabtree would be inducted into the program's Ring of Honor. So Gabe Rivera, E.J. Holub, Dave
Marks. You just caused a lot of my listeners to cuss.
Yeah, Donnie Anderson, Zach Thomas. So Michael Crabtree joining those ranks. And so the conversation then shifted to, okay, well, who's next? Who else deserves to be in the Ring of Honor? And, you know, a lot of folks go, well, Pat Mahomes, obviously. And, you know, Chris Level, my co-host, and I, our point is, if this is based just on what they did at Texas Tech, then Patrick Mahomes does not belong on the Tech football Ring of Honor because he didn't do anything. Like, he put up great numbers, but he has a losing record. You didn't win any bowl games. I don't think that you beat any ranked teams with him as the quarterback. Great numbers, great highlight plays, but if you're telling the story of Texas Tech football, just Texas Tech football, you could probably tell it without Patrick Mahomes. I don't think you could tell it without Graham Harrell or Cliff Kingsbury. Now, we ended up having the director of the Letterman's Association on the show earlier this week, and he's intimately involved in the selection process. And he says that it encompasses their entire football career. So with that in mind, then Pat Mahomes will certainly be in there at some point. But, yeah, but as far as Wells is concerned, he's got bona fides, right? I mean, he's an experienced coach. I think people don't appreciate enough how difficult of a situation it is at Utah State and how impressive, relative to that program's history, his tenure was there. I think people get hung up on the kind of the peaks and valleys of his tenure at Utah State, win 10 games, win three, or I mean, whatever it was. And kind of use those records to kind of fit their perception of him or the narrative that they want to pursue. It was not a popular hire at the time. I remember we were doing a show at the Spirit Arena, like a pregame show for one of the basketball games, when that hire was not announced, but when it kind of became clear it was going in that direction. And that was as hostile of a radio show text line that I have probably ever seen as a host.
Wow.
It was almost universally like, what the bleep. Now, keep in mind, you know, I think a lot of Tech fans have kind of put their hopes on hiring Dana Holgorsen away from West Virginia. And I don't know if that was more about you know, he's been here. He coached under Mike Leach, Air Raid, you know, recapture the magic, or if that was more about, hey, let's steal a sitting head coach away from another Big 12 team and kind of flex a little bit, because if you're Tech football, you haven't been able to do that in a while, or some combination of that, I don't know. And Matt Wells had not, even though we had reported from the beginning that he was in the mix and he was kind of in that group that was seriously in the mix, I don't think anybody ever really believed that Matt Wells would be the guy. And lo and behold, obviously he was. And it seemed like he was pretty much the guy from the beginning from a Kirby Hokut standpoint. And so, you know, the relationship started at that point between Wells and the fans. And I think, you know, naturally, as it pretty much happens with every coaching hire, he has a press conference, introduced. You had that first spring football, and people begin to warm up to him. You have some level of recruiting success, and people are, okay, well, I'm on board with this Matt Wells guy. This is, you know, this is a great change of pace, experienced coach. I like what I'm hearing. And then you go 4-8, and a lot of folks are kind of back to square one. You know, we'll see. I think that hiring a coach is a total crapshoot, whether it's, you know, you're hiring Dana Holgorsen from West Virginia, or you're hiring Mike Leach from Oklahoma, or Charlie Strong from Louisville. You just don't know. Like, you can talk about their records and all these advanced stats and stuff, but there's no surefire metric, right? It's just a total crapshoot. They might be a great fit. They might not be. They might get kind of lucky early on and kind of spin that into some momentum. They might not. I think if you look at Cliff and his time at Tech, there are a handful of kind of 50-50 plays that if they go the other direction, he's probably still the coach here. You look at Mike Leach. I think there are a handful of 50-50 plays where early on, if they go the other way, he's not viewed as some sort of beloved figure in Lubbock. I mean, you kind of referenced it earlier. Like, what if Gideon catches that tip pass and ends the game there, right? I mean, how differently does the last decade play out for Texas Tech? There's a punt return against A&M, a couple of blocked PATs against A&M in 2002. I mean, just a handful of plays can shift everything, and for whatever reason, that didn't happen for Cliff Kingsbury. And based on last year, it didn't happen for Matt Wells. I mean, you had the botched call in Waco with the fumbled snap. By all rights, that should have been a Texas Tech win. It wasn't. They lost in overtime. A number of close games ended up going the other way for Tech. So we'll see. And certainly, as you can imagine, what happened two Saturdays ago didn't really help his cause with Tech fans.
Yeah, I don't think many people realize just where Utah State once was as a football program. It's kind of like where, you know, I was describing UTEP as. Before they played Texas. I mean, you look at some of the advanced metrics and their UTEP is down in the bottom five. Well, once upon a time, Utah State was kind of way down in that region as well. So that's certainly not an easy situation to win at. So if you are winning there at the level that he won, at least for a few seasons, you've got to be doing something right. But yeah, and also too, you mentioned the close games. It seems like that's all Texas Tech was involved in at some point last year. You know, the Baylor one, which should have been a win. Obviously, the Kansas game is a sore subject, I'm sure, with Texas Tech fans. But, you know, TCU could have gone either way. Kansas State could have gone either way. And for a while, that game at Texas was back and forth until Texas pulled away later in that football game. So we'll see if he's able to
and that get was over all, the hump there. And that was all – excuse me, that was all with – an unsettled quarterback situation.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No,
didn't have Bowman.
Yep.
And I don't think – I mean, you should not have lost to Kansas, period. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that. But I think that there is I don't think the Tech fans that have just concluded for themselves that Matt Wells is not going to work out, I don't think that they give him – the benefit of the doubt as far as last year is concerned with the quarterback situation and the close game. I think that it could, yeah, it's tricky, but I don't think enough people kind of put that into account.
Yeah. And also too, you made the point about, you know, the crapshoot that is hiring coaches. The more coaching searches we cover, the more changes we cover, there's so many factors that go into it that people just don't even really consider at all sometimes. You know, I think the Charlie Strong one in particular was a good lesson, at least for me, in terms of, oh, there's a lot of things the head coach has got to do behind the scenes that if they don't do it well, it can really show up on Saturdays in a negative way. One more question about this game this weekend. Is there something that people aren't really talking about from the Texas Tech side, whether it's a player, whether it's a position group, whether it's a storyline, that you think deserves more attention heading into this game?
Well, I'm curious to see how, and you kind of referenced this at the beginning of the podcast, what Tech's linebackers look like. I mean, they weren't really put in a position or that wasn't really a matchup that was going to feature them very much, right? A quick strike, get the ball out of your hand offense. But I think that they have some players there. I mean, Jordan Brooks was a great player for Tech last year, now with the Seahawks. I think going to start on Monday night Sunday against the Cowboys. But Rico Jeffers, Colin Schooler from Arizona, the transfer. You have Brandon Bouye-Randall. You have a number of players there that I think the Tech feels really good about and probably is – not probably. It is the strength of their defense. It's certainly not the secondary. And so I'm really curious to see how they perform against the Texas offense, especially if we see more 12 personnel from the Longhorns that isn't going to go four or five wide every play and, you know, try to get the ball in the hands of their receivers in every play. So that's what I'm kind of mainly curious about. It could end up being, you know, still terrible all over on defense, and Texas can move the ball at will. That's not a surprise. I don't think anybody at all. But we didn't get to see much out of those linebackers against HBU, and so I am curious to kind of see how they perform against probably a more balanced offense than the one they saw in the opener.
Yeah, and I think Texas will try to not necessarily to a fault establish the run or whatever, but I know that's an area that they weren't necessarily completely pleased with against UTEP, and they wanted to be a part. But yeah, the 12 personnel is a great point because, you know, they use those guys in line. They kind of, you know, one of the radio hosts down here, Chad Hastings, one of my buddies, kind of described it well, is that, you know, it's 12 personnel from the label, but it almost is like at times kind of a different personnel from the formation standpoint. But they did use those tight ends in line. They kind of moved them around a little bit. So, yeah, those Texas Tech linebackers be an interesting matchup because I think Texas is going to try to, again, kind of lean on that tight end group because, you know, they're pretty unproven at receiver and probably their best receiver, at least from the camp. Jake Smith is going to be out again. But let's get to the real question of this podcast. How in the hell are we going to fix the Houston Rockets?
I don't know, man. It's a bummer, man.
Like, it is. I remember the day the Covington trade happened, and in my head, I was kind of like, I don't think you can win in the playoffs without a big man. Whether that's a traditional big, whether it's just a big guy. I mean, hell, the Golden State Warriors, when they last went to the NBA Finals twice, started Kevin Looney. Like, you, everybody plays with a big. And then they went out and they played at L.A., that I think their next game. And Covington had a great game, and they won. I was like, okay, like, man, this could work. Like, Russ is going to add that tenacity. And then by the, you know, second round of the playoffs, I'm texting Eddie from our friends at the OU website. And I'm like, how the hell did you survive Russell Westbrook? Like, that is just a playoff roller coaster that I feel like one minute I want to buy all of his jerseys. And the next minute I'm just pounding beers and cussing at him. Like, I don't know what they're going to do. I just don't.
Well, I'm not a fan of the owner and haven't been for a while.
He's got a pretty, let's call it interesting reputation in Houston.
Yeah, I give Daryl Morey a lot of benefit of the doubt. I did not understand the Russell Westbrook trade. It seemed to go against notwithstanding Maury's reputation, probably well-deserved, of always chasing stars, he just doesn't fit what their identity had been for the bulk of Maury's tenure with the team. And yeah, and I think the worst part is, I think this season, and especially the playoffs, it kind of reinforces, really the whole last year for the Rockets, reinforces a lot of the bad things that people say about James Harden, that as a Rockets fan, I, you know, have a natural kind of tendency to resist the idea that he doesn't perform well in the playoffs or in clutch situations. The idea that he is difficult to be around if you are a kind of an equal or a peer in terms of star power, first Dwight Howard, now Chris Paul. I mean, that's a trend. That's not just some coincidence. And so, you know, you couple that with the fact that they just don't have a lot of assets to use, and Harden and especially Westbrook getting up there, it's a depressing time. It's a kind of a bummer. It kind of went from, in the span of 18 months, like, okay, we got a little window here to, all right, well, wake me up in 2024.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that it seems like every great rookie player ended up in the division. At what Dallas has got to play with right now. And then you see what's, you know, oh, Memphis has got a really, really good player as well. And, you know, Spurs probably aren't going to be down for too long. And, yeah, it's you mentioned the Harden thing, and I think it's a great point because myself, I have a natural inclination as well to kind of push back on that. Like, oh, wait a minute, you know, it's not just all on James and there's some other things going on or whatever, but there just are playoff games where he completely disappears. Like, I made the joke on Twitter, I forget what it was. It was during the Oklahoma City series. Russell Westbrook was one of the games. He was just awful. He was wretched. And I was like, Kevin McHale would have benched this guy like a quarter ago. You know, just thinking back to when McHale put Harden on the bench and just wrote it out with, you know, Corey Brewer and Josh Smith, and they ended up winning Jason Terry ended up winning the game. And yeah, it's like, I can't believe that, you know, for Russ, it's one thing. I mean, his up and down, you know, shooting issues have been well documented, but with James, there are playoff games where it's just like, he almost doesn't want the ball. You know, it's kind of weird that one of the plays or the sequences I associate Harden with is there are times, and you can tell maybe how a game's going to go or what kind of mindset he's in, is he gets the ball after another team's make or rebound or whatever, and he just throws these like half quarter, three quarters courts passes into traffic, like just get the ball out of my hands. And it's just one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen from a superstar player, is that they often end up in really bad turnovers. It's like, what? Why are you so anxious to get the ball out of your hands? That's just kind of weird. And I always go back to, you know, the late Kobe Bryant, you know, rest in peace. He was asked about the way the Rockets play, and he goes, it's not going to work in the playoffs. What they do offensively will not work. It's just not going, is the playoffs are a different game. The way they run the offense, you've got to do this and this. It's just not going to work. And, you know, Kobe was one of the brightest basketball minds there is. And I'm starting to kind of shake my head and say, yeah, you know, we just might have to ride this thing out and hope you get lucky. And, you know, at least this season didn't end in the cruel way of where you trade Chris Paul because he wasn't healthy in the playoffs, and then you play Chris Paul in the playoffs and he is healthy and he's kicking your ass, and at times he's the best player on the floor, and then Russell Westbrook isn't healthy for the series. Like, if they would have lost that series that way, I think I might have checked out for months with this team. And as you mentioned, with the owner, who I don't really have any confidence in. We'll see what he does with luxury tax and things like that. But yeah, it's not quite basketball purgatory, but it's close, I think.
Well, at least things are going great for the Astros. Oh, never
mind. Oh man, that woof. I wrote this week in my column, just kind of, you know, I know the Texas Rangers are heading for a rebuild. I think the Astros quietly might be heading for the same when you kind of look at the free agency coming up after this year and the year after that. But let's talk about something better. Tottenham, Gareth Bale. It's weird to see Tottenham like kind of, you know, spending like a massive club and getting these big names, you know. And I know Gareth Bale is older, but he doesn't arrive from Real Madrid like broken. He won 4 Champions League titles. He had a ton of goals. He had a ton of assists. Won the league. Won the League Cup. Whatever it is. And oh, by the way, we get Real Madrid left back as well. Like, are you like me in that just still completely, as much as you can be with your obligations to following college football and then college basketball and everything else? But like, I find myself more immersed now in the Premier League than I've ever been before.
See, I don't know what if it was. If it was getting married and, you know, having to go to third grade soccer games in the morning instead of getting to kind of just kick back and watch EPL all morning, I haven't been able to remain as invested as I once was. And I will say too, that I was gutted by the Pochettino thing. Like I was a big fan of his. And when he, when they moved on from him, I was bummed. I was a big fan because I think that it's always important to have an identity,
right?
In sports, it's like the most important thing. Like it's teams that are talented but just kind of flail around. Oftentimes, you don't know what they are, and I think that, you know, that's what made Texas Tech so good under Mike Leach, was they knew exactly what they were. Everyone knew exactly what they were. You could recruit to it. You could sell it. The same goes for the Rockets. It hasn't been successful, but you know their identity. And I think that they had an identity under him at Spurs. And I don't know what that is now. I was bummed.
Yeah, it's strangely for me, having a 5-month-old has gotten me more into it because, like, it's totally changed my sleep schedule. And it's like, oh, wait, Tottenham plays at 6? I could probably wake up for that if I'm not already up already. Oh, they play at 8? Oh, that's like sleeping in now, you know? Like it's not as difficult as it once was, where it was like, oh, man, they play at 8 or 9? Like, I don't know if I'm going to be up and have my coffee and ready to sit down and watch a full match yet. But, it's – I don't know. For some reason, it's just kind of gripped me more. Even though that Champions League final loss and then just the fallout that happened after that, where it seems like the entire, you know, organization was just broken, you know, the next season they ended up having to make the change. But yeah, I will never forget that Champions League final day, or at least, you know, what I remember of it after the red card. But it's, yeah, if you haven't watched the All or Nothing thing, the documentary on Amazon Prime, it's really helped the access they get, you know, especially for us, you both work in college sports, where the access, I think, is lower than any professional.
Oh, it's a joke.
Whatever.
It's a total joke.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I always joke with those people that kind of move on from the college ranks to the pro ranks. It's like, enjoy your access, you know, enjoy going to the clubhouse or the locker room, which I know now is different because of COVID. But yeah, it's just college athletics, like the access is just so sad. And then you put on one of those documentaries and it's like, geez, you've got a camera in the manager's office when he's having one-on-one, like, real conversations with star players? Like, that's, wow, okay, that's kind of eye-opening. It's really well done, and I'd highly recommend it. It's kind of pushed me into the Jose Mourinho side. So we will see if he delivers before probably going out in a blaze of glory like he did at Manchester.
Have you, speaking of the EPL and documentaries, I am assuming that you watched Sunderland Till I Die on Netflix.
No, I haven't. Not yet.
Oh, Dustin, I need you to hang up right now.
how long are we talking? Because my Fridays are usually pretty slow.
Oh, I think it's two seasons.
Okay.
It's a documentary series. It follows Sunderland. It starts the year after they were relegated from the EPL, and it kind of follows their journey to try and get back up to the Premier League. But it focuses more on the club than the players, if that makes sense. You hear more from the cafeteria workers than you do in some cases from some of the players, and fans too. Like, you hear from the fans. It's fascinating. It is very, very good. Very good.
I will add it to my list for sure. One last one, because I've kept you long enough already. What's life like in Lubbock right now? You know, for any of those Texas fans that are going to make the trip up there this weekend, like, you know, I know things down here in Austin are opening up more. I think you're starting to see more people out. You're starting to see, unfortunately, a little bit more traffic, not to the levels that it was normally, but it just seems like life isn't normal, but it's kind of inching its way to that. You know, how has Lubbock kind of dealt with everything that's going on? I know probably like Austin, there's been a lot of local places, you know, some of the longstanding favorite places down here haven't survived, you know, which has unfortunately been one of the biggest negatives about this pandemic. Obviously the health reasons and lives lost and things like that, but, you know, just the businesses that haven't been able to survive. So how has Lubbock kind of handled thing? And if anybody is making the trip up there, are there any recommendations you'd make for them?
I mean, Evie Mays is an easy recommendation. It is certainly the best barbecue in West Texas. And I would say that it is one of the better spots in the state. But I think it's like outside of the masks, you know, it's pretty normal. Like there have been some places that have shut down. You know, bars aren't you know, open or whatever yet. But beyond that, I mean, people are going out to eat. People are going to soccer games out at the soccer complex on Saturday mornings. You know, my stepson has a game on Saturday. He's got a football game on Sunday. Practices. So I think for the most part, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, outside of masks, I think it's pretty much back to normal. You know, I think that there are some, like, I think Level's daughter plays volleyball, and so they've, you know, marked off areas at the court for folks to sit in or not sit in. But yeah, I think generally it's pretty much normal. Like if you took away the masks, I don't know that you would notice a difference between now and last September.
That's good to hear. And I am looking forward to seeing some tortillas flying, because that'll kind of make me feel like things are getting closer to normal. If I can flip on a game or at least see some of that. I know Sam Ellinger had a comment about it down here, that he's like, it might only be 25%, but we're kind of expecting them to see him. That's always – that'll be a welcome sight as we kind of get closer to returning to life as normal, hopefully sooner than later. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for the time, man. I've kept you so long. I feel like I owe you the equivalent of like 10 radio appearances now for as long as this podcast is gone. But make sure you follow Aaron on Twitter at Aaron Dickens. And of course, the guys at RedRaiderSports.com cover Texas Tech better than anybody. They've been doing it for a long, long, long time. And if you want to, tune in to Tech Talk 97.3 from 3 to 6 p.m. on Double T 97.3. If you want to get a feel for what's going on in Lubbock and what's being talked about heading into this game this weekend. But let's wrap it up. Another edition of the Dustin McComas Show at TheYak.com. I am Dustin McComas of OrangeWoods.com. Stay safe. Wear a mask. Until I talk to y'all next time, take care.